Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast. Profoundly honored today with return guest, urban warfare expert John Spencer. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. So, 1 year ago, I had this idea for a podcast, The Yoga of War. Important conversations about Israel and anti-Semitism. By extraordinary luck, I found myself in a DM chat with an absolute hero of truth and morality, urban warfare expert John Spencer. I have to be honest, when I asked if he would be the first guest on my show, well, I didn't exactly tell him he would be the first guest. I never thought he would actually say yes. And a week later, John and I shot the first episode of the Yoga of War podcast. It was an incredible honor then, and it is an incredible honor today as John returns to the show to celebrate its first year. To be honest, I still can't believe he's here. John Spencer is one of the world's leading experts on urban warfare. He's the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point, host of the Urban Warfare Project podcast, and executive director of the Urban Warfare Institute. John served over 25 years in the US Army as an infantry soldier and officer, including two combat deployments to Iraq. He currently serves as a colonel in the California State Guard as the director of Urbear, right? That's the word we're looking for here, right? That's when
Or
you
Uber.
Uber Urban Warfare Training for the 40th Infantry Division. You would think after saying the word urban warfare like 10 times in the last minute, I would get it out of my mouth. But no. He's a co-author of Understanding Urban Warfare and author of the mini manual for the Urban Defender and Connected Soldiers, Life, Leadership, and Social Connections in Modern War. John, I can't thank you enough for helping me to celebrate 1 year of the Yoga of War.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. So today I do want to focus primarily, of course, on Gaza, but I'd like to start in a somewhat unlikely location. You just returned from a trip to India to study Operation Sindoor. Reading your Sunday Guardian article about it, for me at least, swap Israel for India and Iran for Pakistan, and it would just as effectively describe Operation Rising Lion. Swift and complete air dominance, long-range precision strikes on strategic military targets, avoidance of full-scale war, and diminishing the enemy from towering to cowering in very short order. But it seems that both of these wars ended more in messages than victories, paving a perhaps slightly winding road back to the status quo. Is this how all wars end now? Like, not in decisive and permanent victories, but in premature ceasefires, fires, and mainly just kicking the can?
Well, that's a wonderful question to start off with. As you know, I can never leave my, professor instructor roots. There's a famous military historian, Michael Howard, who wrote an article that I use almost daily, which is the use misabuse of military history, and that it, when we're studying wars or the history of war. I'm not a historian. I'm a war researcher. That important amount of context. You also have to study within the width and depth of a conflict or an action, but context matters so much. So the answer to your question is no, of course, because each war has its own context, starting at the very strategic, or what are the goals for both sides? And then, what is the significance of the end? Some people have nuances of war versus operation. When's the start date? When's the end date? I have my own thoughts on, as I write case studies, which I, it's a research methodology, comparative analysis using case studies. So a same framework. So like going, studying Operation Rising Lion is a case study, as well as for me, Operation Sindor. You're right, there are some similarities we can point to, but some vast contrasts. What India's goal was for the war was to respond to an immediate terrorist attack, which shouldn't be forgotten, which kind of gets forgotten in the news, the awfulness of a terrorist attack. And I just posted about October 7th this morning because it's scarred in my mind as it is with millions. But Operation Rising Lion had a goal to stop an imminent threat, to reestablish a new doctrine towards that threat, both not just between Israel and Iran, but the United States as well as some strategic leadership in that. So for Operation Sindor, terrorism being the common card here, state-sponsored terrorism, which is different, right? So you have lots of terrorist groups that aren't state-sponsored. Through different ways, they might be supported clandestine, but Pakistan and Iran are two mutual, long-term, decades-long backers of terrorism, as in funding, training, and deploying terrorists from their territories into others for proxy means, which is not new as well. So the ending of wars, right? So when does a war end? Which is a really big question. I always go back to, and I'm sure we'll talk about Gaza, is okay, when did the operation that we're talking about start? What were the strategic objectives established by both sides? And that's what you have to measure everything. When you start to get very loose on when did this start? What are the grievances underneath this? That lends people to go in many different directions when I like to keep it contained.
So, how in that framework can we ever avoid these forever wars? I mean,
So,
I could argue that Israel and the Palestinians will absolutely be forever. I might argue that Pakistan and India might have some I don't know, some broader possibilities. I don't know, but so it just seems like, yeah, forever is built into that answer.
there's a conflict continuum. So I don't believe in the term forever war. Some people view that as a kind of synonymous with wars that protracted warfare or a war that didn't have a clear ending, like Vietnam, Afghanistan, which there was a clear goal. It's just there's no way to achieve it with the current strategy, and that gets used by many people, especially now, saying Iraq and Afghanistan were forever wars. It's just misapplication of terms. There is the use of the word war as well, right? So, two societies can be vastly misaligned and ideologically, like Iran, whose sole being as the Islamic regime of Iran is to destroy something else. That's their ideology. I mean, that's what they say every day. They chant that saying they've always been at war. Like, this war didn't start. And this is back where I'm going, like, no. There is a start date to this. There's an end date. Does that end everything? Which is your question too about Sindor, is that you don't go back to the status quo. Neither in Operation Rising Lion nor in Operation Sindor is there just immediate reverse back to status quo. And I think that's really important because by the fact that one side kind of says, "I'm done with the status quo," right? Israel said, "We're not going to continue to let you get you closer and closer to the nuclear bomb," and they acted. Same thing with Sindor. Like, we're not going to allow you to do this terrorist attack. And there's lots of histories there with the 2008 Mumbai attacks, 16, 19, even 2001 with a parliament building terrorist attack. And there's always been a different diplomatic kind of response. So those are the nuances that I like to point out as well, is that this is not going back to the status quo. This is a strategic shift, even within regions, right? What we've seen happen in the Middle East, thanks to Israel, is a shift that is generational, that people, if they're haters of Israel, don't want to highlight. And if others are just not connecting the dots between, President Trump's trips around the Gulf states and, historic economic ties to, the fall of the defanging of Hezbollah, the fall of Syria, the defanging of all of these elements. These are generational changes that are the outputs of the war. But you're right. Some of these groups won't ever stop wanting to kill somebody. So there's always that gets you to this idea of, like, how do you kill an idea, an ideal. I don't believe in that. I believe, people hate others to include being radicalized that their sole being, and you can go into fundamental religion at the foundation of that, to hate other people. But that isn't necessarily having the capability to attack the arms, the nuances of borders and the diplomatic and the law and all that stuff. It's really hard to kill an ideal. That's true. But it is very, very straightforward on how do you remove somebody's power to hurt you. I can't convince people. There are economic and there's a theory of like de-radicalization, reconciliation, all this stuff that is the gray areas that people will start to put into buckets of forever wars, right? There are plenty of case studies of what right looks like, right? Post-World War II, Imperial Japan, Germany. There are other cases where an entire population is de-radicalized from saying that their entire existence is destruction of somebody else. And then you want people to have shared human values of development and progressiveness. And it's so many, and this is why I have a lot of job security, because there's so many tentacles to that very simple question.
And also, you're really good at your job. So before we move on, I do want to just mention one more thing about Pakistan, only because I read it just last night. Pakistan has absolutely no skin in the Gaza game, of course. Yesterday, Pakistan's defense minister threatened to break the Israeli naval blockade, a la Greta Thunberg, to deliver aid directly to Gaza if a peace is not reached this week. And if Pakistan is intercepted, which of course we know they will be, they say they will strike Israel militarily. So many experts, and I know I sound naive when I keep asking people this question, but I just can't like deny what my eyes are seeing. Like everyone is insisting we are not witnessing the start of World War III. I personally believe we're already in it. It sure seems like the nations of the earth are all like lining up with either the allies or the axis of evil. In your estimation, like where is this all honestly heading?
So, again, going back to my kind of they're not maxims, but these underlining theories. This is why I love my job, military theory. You can get into international relations theory, you can get into political sciences. For war, there is always an evolving character, right? The technologies and I call those things out when something's fundamentally changed in the character of war on how do you penetrate somebody's borders, the deep intelligence penetrations that Israel did against Iran. Those are what we call character of wars. But the nature of war, the fact that it's human, it's political, and it's uncertain will never change. So you asked me for where this is heading. There's nobody, and if you have somebody on your show, and it's been amazing to watch it grow, who tells you can make those predictions, then probably don't have them on anymore. I can say that all wars, especially major wars, right? We've only had two, so there's been a lot of people predicting the next one, right? The third one, that there are all kinds of underlying predictions and contributing factors to the triggering moment that led to World War I and World War II. It isn't like everybody didn't see the writing on the wall, from nationalism to the rise of all these groups, and it all adds up. I think we were headed towards, I wouldn't say War III, the world, from a very geopolitical perspective, for many reasons, to include nations saying like, oh, I'm not going to have a military. I don't believe in this. A peace for everybody had led us to a very unstable situation. And this is where you can put people in these buckets. And yeah, if they declare themselves in that bucket now, that's something different. But really, all this instability from the Ring of Fire around Israel to Iran's nuclear program to Putin's, throwing aside international norms, was taking Georgia, Crimea, like all this stuff was building, and it was a lack of leadership, right? This is the ideal that, the anti-war people think that there are other ways to achieve peace. Well, your way just showed it led to these breaking points where it all boiled out, whether that's, Iran's nuclear progress or, many other factors. And you can go into the economic, and this is again why my job security is that in order to understand war, you have to understand so many fields of study because they do interact with each other. I actually think, thanks to the last Israel's work and the United States' work and others, we're heading into a period of stability, not instability. If you understand Pakistan's comments, right, and I really recommend Natan Sharansky's book, Give Democracy a Chance. You won't agree with everything in it, but he really has some really amazing frameworks to think about fear societies, right? So he was talking about Soviet Union, but he talked about places like, Judea and Samaria. When you live under a fear society, and what the governments have to, what they say, despite it's like total Orwellian, not reality, like, I'm going to do this. And who are they talking to? Like, Pakistan's not going to do anything. Who are you talking to? You talking to your population? And this is the same thing with Iran and Pakistan, who can be completely dominated in a operation or a war, and then the next day have a victory parade. It's that
Right.
level of insanity.
So you don't think that they're going to send a flotilla to break the barricade?
No.
Okay.
And there's and then there's the need, right? So they want to jump on these social media trends
Yeah.
like that flotilla, which is a selfie flotilla. I mean,
Right.
Greta Thunberg ate more of the supplies than the ship by the
Right.
time she got there. They did. Their boat ate more of the supplies
Right.
they had on their boat ready to be delivered. These are such ridiculous. And the amount of food that's pouring into Gaza right now, this is where you could see the. And they think what the problem is we're a Westerner, and there's this aspect of a Westerner not understanding that insanity. Like, that's stupid. Some of it does sell to internal audiences that they're talking to, right? It's like, oh,
Yeah.
my country cares, like things like that. So I wouldn't like totally like brush it away, but for us, it's like that's stupid.
Yeah. I think that Greta had a better chance of getting through only because she wasn't threatening military. And if she did threaten military repercussions, I don't think anyone would have worried about it. So when we look at the geopolitical landscape and its absolute minefield of triple standards, as you call them, against Israel, I can't help but to point out that even after Russia's unprovoked military offensive into Ukraine, a year and a half before Israel was savagely invaded on October 7th, 2023, there's exactly no one insisting that Russia end their war. Trump has told Putin he wants the war to end. Putin says no. Trump throws up his hands. He's like, well, that sucks. And yet, nation after nation, including traditional allies, have been piling the pressure on Israel to end their defensive and existential war pretty much since the day it started. So, my question is, do you think Netanyahu will fight until all of the hostages are home and Hamas is dismantled? Or do you think he's ultimately going to have no choice but to succumb to international pressure?
So it's an interesting comparison, as I spent a lot of time in Ukraine as well doing research, and the scale of that geopolitical significance of upsetting the global international order, a sitting member of the one UN body that actually has a purpose and has the authorities to do something, the UN Security Council, and the fact that Russia sits on it and then violates even the charter of the United Nations and a war of aggression and trying to say that borders don't matter. Like, there's so many issues there. So to answer your question, very straightforward, no. Because the prime minister of Israel doesn't determine what Israel does. It's a democracy. The society determines whether the war continues. Of course, the society says every hostage home, everybody, living or dead, unfortunately, and that's the type of conversation we're having. Israel won't stop for that. Now, the broader perspective of will Israel's society say that the ultimate goal of the removal of Hamas is a power in Gaza? I've been saying from the beginning that having studied war for a long time, and despite the, and in what I was told, Israeli senior national leaders themselves to, military to society. And I visited the, hostage square and the nightly basically protests and things like that. Everybody says, no way, we're going to do this until it's in. And then you see society saying, like, well, how do you achieve that end? They think it's going to happen quickly, and it's not. You're not going to remove a power in an unlimited goal like that quickly. So I can't answer that because the society will answer that quickly of whether it's they're willing to. And as we're talking, an unfortunate event in Gaza last night with the IDF soldier's death, that of course is felt across the entire nation, a very small nation, right? So that, and then they start to ask, like, okay, we don't want to pay this price anymore. I know that's the goal. And this is where you elect political leaders to make those hard decisions. Like, we have to. If not, we will only see this. Yeah, we'll have peace for another 10 years or so. But they're not going to stop if they remain in power. And now they're victorious in their own minds. I can't answer that question. I know the prime minister has been very, every time I've interviewed him personally, he's been very steadfast on these are the three goals, and there is no alternative to them. And how do you get there is a question, right? So this is where you get into, well, what's the plan to get there? Well, it isn't as straightforward as people try to make it.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you're saying about what the public wants, because when you look at how much discord there's been in Israeli society over the war and the demands that people are making, I think that ultimately Bibi has been making. Or when I say Bibi, sorry, I'm talking about the whole the cabinet, the IDF. I'm talking about all of them, but he's the guy who's getting the flak. But he keeps making these decisions that enrage people until they sort of unfold and they're like, oh, okay, never mind. That was okay. So I am wondering how much the intelligence of the leadership really does drive this boat rather than the populace. But I do want to talk about that really tragic ambush and mass casualty event last night. Which was just horrifying. So many people are arguing that recently accelerated IDF losses combined with few very strategic gains and really no progress on the hostage front. I mean, there's no chance, I shouldn't say no chance, there's next to no chance of saving more hostages the way that Noah Argamani, for example, was saved now that they have all the hostages surrounded by people with guns. But people are saying that all of these factors are sort of like the bellwether that it's time to end this war. So I personally believe that we need maximum pressure until all the hostages are home and our objectives are met. But as an expert, at what point do military operations have such a like low marginal rate of return that they're no longer worth engaging in?
Again, that's a society. One is that, okay, so there are many factors in that. One is, the fact that somebody believes that there is a bloodless war, right? So societies have become, and this is not the case in Ukraine and Russia, right? They're sacrificing thousands a day for their freedom, right? But within certain, I don't know what we call them, major rules of thought, that the loss of soldiers would lead to that strategic kind of questioning of the goals. I don't personally, I mean, every loss is felt intensely because of the small nature, the proximity, what the Israeli society is. So there are some differences there compared to other wars, and every this is why the context matters. There is no point of when does this decide? Because there's so many aspects of, sunk cost fallacy. Like, is there actually a plan to achieve the goal? And this is the frustration I know that I've heard since October 7th. Okay, how do we achieve these three goals? We all agree that these are the three goals. Now, how do we achieve them? And I'm the kind of guy, like I did with the Times of Israel and Laizer Berman, is like, look, okay, I understand the criticism, but let's talk about the context of every moment in time along this path to how we got here. What is the current situation, which is where I like to deal with, like, okay, here's the situation we're in now. We want to talk about how we got here and all the decisions, and this is that reflection. Well, you could have done it differently back then. I'm like, okay, let's talk about that when you're talking about, like, what was going on in Israel with all the different vectors of attack and all the geopolitical, US election, like all these elements. When is it for the Israeli society a point of diminishing returns? this is where you have to put it into that very broader perspective, right? Hezbollah wasn't defeated and destroyed. Hezbollah was defanged and deterred. And same thing with Iran. It wasn't defeated. It's not going to stop, but it was rolled back. For Gaza, though, and why it's so hard for people to kind of swallow the cost and the path is that in order to achieve that goal of removing Hamas from power, there is no historical case study of that happening easily, without cost, without time. And this is a problem. And I wrote this article for the Wall Street Journal about these fallacies that have evolved in societies. Some of it coming out of academia, right? So you have all these social sciences fields of study that try to convince the world that wars are won through sanctions and all this stuff. And like, look at the history of war. It is costly to achieve the peace, right? So this is so what is the cost for of peace? And this whether you're Thomas Paine or you name the famous quote, oftentimes there is a great cost. This is why we don't want War III, because of the cost of 70 million people dead, and the cost of that is almost hard for people to fathom, especially young people. The cost of peace in Israel is a lot, and that's unfortunate that it led to this path. And we can criticize past administrations and even societal decisions. In order to achieve a peace with Gaza on that periphery, it would take a great amount of work and, unfortunately, cost. So then the society says, well, the cost worth it to have peace for a very long time or a short amount of peace? Because even the history of peace with different factions in the Middle East, you can have a quick, short amount of time, or you can have an ultimate amount of time. And that's why, like, the Abraham Accords is a monumental progression for Israel in the trajectory of its short history. When you have Arab nations since October 7th helping defend Israel, that can't be that's an amount of peace that other people would say would never have been possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I really do believe that the chances of peace in the Middle East are much more likely to come from peace from the outside than war pushing from the inside. So I do I before we get all the way back into Gaza, I want to touch on the dinner last night between Trump and Bibi. They had a working dinner, not a formal meeting in the Oval Office. But it is assumed that Trump is putting and has put significant pressure, of course, on Bibi to make a deal. He loves deals. And some people will say any deal. So even this partial deal with Hamas. Already, the proposed Witkoff framework as written is extremely favorable to Hamas, but Hamas knows that the more they refuse a deal, the more pressure falls on Netanyahu to capitulate. They have zero agency. Israel has made such tremendous progress in Gaza, and Hamas is all but defeated. It seems a 60-day ceasefire deal now is going to dial back all those gains, all that momentum, and it feels like these talks are premature and should only happen at the point, which seems near. Some people are saying maybe a few months away, 2 or 3 months away, when Israel has the absolute dominance to dictate terms and get all of the 50 hostages out instead of once again huge concessions and dribs and drabs. I'm wondering what your feelings are about the current ceasefire negotiations.
It's a hard one, and I've gotten this over the last the last 20 plus months. I have absolutely been in favor of every temporary ceasefire to bring hostages home, because it was the right thing to do without giving away Israel's forever peace. The fact that temporary pauses while Hamas strategized their strategy to survive the war. Especially the last one where they flooded northern Gaza with 1 million citizens onto rubbled, IED'd, the humanitarian aspects of the humanitarian aid and trying to control that. But the cost benefit of these short pauses, which were only coming because of the military pressure. I do firmly believe that you wouldn't have, just in a kind of even what we call game theory, you wouldn't have Hamas coming to the table to do this if it wasn't threatening to their survival. And there are actually many things present in Gaza now that are threatening the survival of Hamas beyond the five divisions of IDF. So I'm actually in favor of this 60-day pause, as long as, and I think Israel won't negotiate away Hamas being the ruling power. And there's always conversations that I'm just not aware of, some of that will come out later, of like all these different countries, because it's not black and white. I mean, I don't think you should be negotiating with Hamas at all, but I know it's a deal with the devil that has to be made because of the fact that they took these hostages, and why we can't validate this ever happening again by allowing for concessions like the survival of Hamas to come out of the fact that they took hostages. Like that being the only reason, where you try to have these objective assessments of, I understand if it was my son or daughter, I mean, there would be no cost I would be willing to pay to bring them home. But you know, when you're talking about the safety of an entire nation, and that the fact, not just in the now, but the fact that taking hostage would lead to geopolitical and ramifications, can't be validated in any way. So I'm in favor of a 60-day ceasefire, if whatever Hamas wants besides its survival, to bring hostages home now. The IDF, of course, will assume a lot of risk to themselves when they restart, just like this IED that was in a road that was exploded, that was probably put in during the last ceasefire, coordinated ambushes, and the reforming that was done. That's the risk that the IDF know they're taking each time that there is a pause, and the amount of work that has to be redone. But as long as you don't give away the Hamas staying in power, right? So there are these conversations about convincing them. And then again, Hamas today isn't what it was October 6th. It's not even in many aspects the same individuals. Yes, it's the same ideology, radicalized, supported in some senses, and but not by the entire population, as we see parts of the Gazan population resisting Hamas, which is great. They're all fragments of what is the end state, but I'm in favor of the pause, and I don't think Israel is going to negotiate away that non-negotiable of Hamas can't stay in power. You know, there are many ways that that can happen, right? With these, you know, the humanitarian zone, the clans, the international group comes in, you know, all this stuff, the demilitarized aspects. But right now, to bring, because every day that a hostage stays in captivity is a negative. I understand it will cost you more on the back end, and I think most people understand that.
I think, John, for me personally, I could tell you, and I think a lot of people feel the same way. There's nothing I wouldn't give to bring hostages home, but the pain of thinking of leaving half of them there is what's so excruciating. And so I understand what you're saying, but it's this, as you know, many people have said, it's this Sophie's choice of like, you know, that you know, Gali can come home, but his you know twin brother can't. Or you know, do we bring home Matan because he's very sick, or does he stay there because he's the least likely to survive? It's the old who do you throw over you know the edge of the boat in order to save the boat because who's the most likely to survive? Or so I just think that. Everybody wants hostages home, there's no question, but the choices are utterly excruciating. Now, the demands that Hamas are making honestly are untenable. I mean, it's not just what it's not just the ceasefire. I mean, we're talking about they want Barghouti back. They want the end of the GHF. They want retreat from the advances with now that Israel has 65 to 75% control of the strip. They want the war to end. They want like the list goes on. As far as I'm concerned, Israel is only in Doha to say, listen, we're not the one who sunk this ship. I think that both Bibi and Netanyahu know and acknowledge that there probably won't be a truce, and that is going to be the nail in the coffin that Israel says, okay, we're going in full force. And we're going to finish this job now, done and done. But what will that mean for the hostages?
Yeah, there's so many aspects that have along this conversation that are unique to Israel, right? So if we were to remove Israel and just create a scenario involving, a non-state actor, terrorist force, and run all the scenarios, and like, of course, the civilians should be able to get out through Egypt and get out of the way. Of course, all these elements wouldn't be present in any other situation, and this is why. Of course, you wouldn't negotiate with a terrorist organization holding your people. Like, there's so many elements here that people don't understand are so unique to this situation, to Israel, even the geopolitical aspects, like you said, with Pakistan's comments of the fact that these, even the Hamas people who design, financed everything, are billionaires living in luxury in Qatar where the negotiations are happening. I mean, these things are unparalleled in human history, and because it's Israel. So developing like, okay, what is the school of even the history of warfare say about what should happen? There's a lot of this that shouldn't be happening. You're right, like negotiations are stopped, full fledged multi-division assault, clearing every piece of ground, and there's still 30%, and I wouldn't even say they control 70%. I know that's the goal right now. 30 plus percent that Israel has never gone into out of many reasons, like concerns for the hostages, but it's because there's all these unique features of the war in Gaza, like the presence of the civilians and these zones that are basically no-go zones because you can't get the civilians out, and there's all these different plans to get over these hurdles that are so unique to that. You probably understand. I mean, having studied this for so long is, but I'm kind of the guy going like, this is crazy to be that people don't understand how unique this situation is. And you have all these talking heads are like, this is what should happen and all this stuff. And like, do you understand how unique this is to war? Is that this Israeli standard, even in returning their hostages, in after October 7th, and there's so many elements here. And can I tell you here's what needs to be done? I can tell you that there's no other nation that would have done it this way, because there's no other nation that would be forced to do it this way.
Absolutely. In like high on the list of demands that I think most people see as the most innocuous, but quite honestly, in my opinion, is really going to be the game changer in the whole war is that Hamas and of course the UN are insisting that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation be dismantled. But
If I
it
was just
seems
if I was to explain that to my sixth grade kid, like, hey, there's this group who's handing out millions of meals a day to the people, and the people that need it are getting it, but we need to stop that. Like, it makes no common sense.
But it does make sense to the extent that he who controls the food controls the population. And Hamas understands that, but the rest of the world just seems to be like completely lost on this concept. But you're right. Again, another double standard. What other nation besides Israel, would ever be almost universally condemned for successfully delivering about 65 million meals in a few weeks to the enemy? I mean, it's surreal. Hamas and the UN are frantic, insisting that a hostage deal is going to hinge, among other things, upon Israel and the US turning the aid distribution back over to UNRWA and the World Food Program so Hamas can again hijack the aid, hold it for ransom, and use the proceeds to fund their terror machine. Now, again, this seems to be the most innocuous of the demands, but to me, I actually think this is going to be the linchpin of victory for Israel. How important do you think GHF is to these ultimate negotiations?
Yeah, it's critical within the context of the Hamas strategy of using these political theaters like the United Nations comments about the humanitarian crisis that the world will step in previous cases for a humanitarian crisis. That's normal. So the food is the linchpin to the Hamas strategy to force the world to say, like, look, like I know Israel, your goals are just, but we just can't let this continue. For whatever reason, you're right. Just like Hamas's requirement for the last ceasefire about sending all the people back into northern Gaza. Some people was like, oh, yeah, of course, let them go home. Like, no, you don't understand. One, that they're putting all of them at jeopardy, but it was ultimately in this their strategy to survive the war and achieve a victory. So same thing, this has been the greatest threat to their power over the population, like you said. And then you have to do the kind of the analysis of like, okay, where in any other situation has the entire population been solely dependent on international aid, so much so that it can be the sole power for somebody to survive, is who controls that aid, because there is no self-production of it even before the war, right? So there's that aspect, the aspect that nobody's allowed to leave. And I know that came up in the dinner last night. Like, what about letting Gazans who want to leave Gaza out? And nobody understanding how historically abnormal that is to trap a population and say, look, it's not okay. No, you can't, they can't leave. Like, we're making, not we, not me, like United Nations is making the decision, like, to talk about self-determination. Like, I want to move my family out of this war zone. Yeah, but you can't. We're not gonna let you. Like, that's insane.
Well, the irony is, so not only so what we're talking about here is refugees, and at the same time, these people consider themselves to be eternal refugees. So what is it? But yeah, I mean, people don't even realize what Egypt has set up on the Rafah border. You've seen it. I've only seen it in pictures, but it's like a wall, 30 feet of wire, another wall. It's like
Yeah, it's insane.
Nobody
And
will
then,
take
yeah,
these people in.
draw a map of what the Sinai is and how insane. And this is for me, of the many motivations, is this can't become the standard in war. That's insane to say. The number one thing that is protects civilians is moving them out of harm's way. And the history of war of them leaving temporarily, even if that, or setting up what we call displaced persons camps, like, that's historic. And to do that in the Sinai would have taken and would have not protracted this to the point that it is at this point. It would still be hard to remove Hamas as the power, but that one factor to get people like the United Nations to acknowledge, like, you caused this. You want to blame Israel. You caused this by forcing something that's never happened in the history of war, where there's a gate and there's one person saying, not one person coming out of this gate unless you pay $10,000, because there have been like 100,000 Gazans who have paid their way out. But then the United Nations to back that, like, yeah, that's right, we shouldn't be allowing people to leave. What? Now forced, there is that issue of forced expulsion, right? But there's just no historical precedence, and I don't want to live in a world where there is, saying that in a war zone, you're not allowed to leave.
Well, again, John, you and I both know that this is a ridiculous double standard that will not occur anywhere else. 4 million refugees left Ukraine. It's a normal course of war. But let me just because. Boy, time is going fast. We can't really discuss the end of Hamas without factoring in the humiliation of Iran in the 12-day war. Over the last 21 months, we've seen the extinguishing, really, of the whole ring of fire with no one but like the far-off Houthis left to fight Iran's fight. And I'll personally argue that their downfall is probably not too far in the distant future. But since the IRGC is no longer in a position to support Hamas, do you think that Qatar or the Muslim Brotherhood is going to step in to fill that void, or is this going to ultimately choke Hamas off of their funding?
So, I mean, again, you've been talking about it for a while, so you know that Iran will sacrifice all of these proxies without thinking twice. The IRGC built them to be sacrificed. And the crown jewel of their investment was Hezbollah, not Hamas, right? And if you understand, even if you spent any time in the Middle East and you understand the Shia Sunni divide, the fact that the IRGC is backing Hamas is not a straightforward, like, why is that happening? Other than a mutual kind of radicalized population willing to all die in pursuit of their goal. And like, literally, that's the goal, is to be born to sacrifice yourself in the death. So of course the IRGC is like, oh, I'll fund that. I don't think that tie has been there since October 7th, to be honest, although there has been intelligence that revealed that it was IRGC directed. It was to derail the normalization process that was the greatest threat to the IRGC's plan for the Middle East. But once October 7th happened, especially when they sealed Gaza off from the Egypt, super highway of being able to influence things, there is very little, there's nobody coming to Hamas's aid other than this cabal of international human rights disinformation.
That's
Right?
funny.
So this is that, and I've been dealing with these people for a very long time, the anti-war, anti-Israel, anti-common sense crowd, and they have the title of credibility based on institution that has no credibility historically, like on what they say. But there is no, you're right. I wouldn't say the Ring of Fire has been put out. Of course, the Quds Force and the IRGC, it's a mammoth. The
Sure.
Hezbollah fight is not gone, although there's lots of indicators of progress. And with the Syria fight, and without that drug trade money going, there's so many tentacles of this. But Hamas is isolated, right? This is why they're fighting so desperately for a path to surviving, even though they're not the same people. That it's not that Iran tie is not their survival at all.
So how, because Israel is saying they are going to fight until Hamas is deposed, how do you envision the end of Hamas rule? I mean, would their, do you think their leadership would ever agree to be exiled, or will the organization simply be humiliated and defanged like Hezbollah? And I agree, like the fire isn't out, but they're just embers. Now, I have a friend whose fire embers that were 3 days old were thrown in the trash, and literally her whole house burned down. So I know how important in devastating embers could be. But while the fire's down, what happens with Hamas ultimately?
So ultimately, if you don't replace the power in the Gaza Strip, Hamas will survive and rebuild out of the ashes, like you said. They'll look for new lines of support. They'll rebuild in their own way. The radicalization will continue with the UNRWA books and the Sesame Street and all these elements that are the underneath the name, right? So that Hamas is the name. Could somebody come in and change the name, right? And this is historical as well. Like, I'm not Hamas, right? I'm somebody else. But it's the same thing on a different card. I can't tell you what the direction, because there's so many variables of what the Gaza Strip is, right? It's not Judea and Samaria. They're violently opposed to each other. There's so many very unique aspects to what is the Gaza Strip, what is the population, what is Hamas. I can say as a strategist that if you don't replace the power, then there is that Hamas is still there. And you could, this is the ideals of, backing the clans temporarily to fight Hamas. And then how do you build something else, right? What was it in the beginning? This is the whole failed nation building, counterinsurgency thing that everybody doesn't want to get into. Just as a straight strategist, though, if you don't replace the power, and this is very, just as of this morning, right, a kind of disagreement between Israel's leadership and the IDF about moving the population into southern Gaza and governing them. And you have resistance to that because it's really messy, really hard to do. But temporarily, I've been of the position, if you're not willing, as in Israel, to temporarily be the governing power, then you're on a long path to anything else being the power in Gaza. There is this idea of, like, islands. You could do it by islands in Gaza Strip. So you could create an island, which is basically what they're doing. They're just trying to build one island in southern Gaza, and then have something else be the governing power, like an international group. That's a way. You could make their different islands. In order for Hamas to be removed, there has to be another power. And to think otherwise, it's just not logical in my kind of study of the history of war. But so you asked me for like what happens with Hamas. It's really hard because the Gaza Strip is very unique, just in the variables that are present. And the idea that you could just in name replace Hamas with something, or is it a variations of something? So many aspects to the history of Egypt and Gaza, the groups that are there, the Fatah versus Hamas, Palestinian Authority. I can say very simplistically, if you don't replace the power, like it's just not going to wither away, right? You can weaken it so that another power can survive, right? This is the idea that you could have given the Gaza Strip to the Palestinian Authority in December of 2023. No, you couldn't. Hamas is more than just arms and people. It is a power. So you had to weaken that power, and Israel has done that very well. But even then, you have to be able to secure, because it might be, there's some famous quotes about having power in an area where security might be one of your problems, but it's 99% of your problems until you fix it. So just the fact that there are still Hamas with arms is going to make it really hard for anybody to survive. So it goes back to the clearing operations. You haven't cleared Gaza. You haven't cleared it of its weapons and even heavy weapons. Even this ambush we talked about happened with an IED explosion and then an ambush of small arms and medium-sized weapons. Like, you have to demilitarize. You have to, in order for another power to exist, even if it's completely, Palestinian or Gazan, it can't survive without removing Hamas's capabilities and power.
Yeah. And one of the big problems, quite honestly, is that UNRWA is inextricably linked and tied to Hamas, and UNRWA is considered to be like the good guys, right? They're the UN. Of course they're good. And by the way, the people of Gaza hate the PA. It would cause civil war if the PA were just if we tried to, people think that overthrowing, say, Ayatollah Khamenei is going to create a power vacuum and it's going to create chaos and this and that. If you take the PA and put them into Gaza, I mean, the whole place would implode. Now, I think that the US, at least under Donald Trump, is committed to dismantling UNRWA, finally ending the Palestinian myth of perpetual refugeehood, among other things. But you also touched upon something that is so important, which is the education, i.e., indoctrination of the last 18 years of youth to join the jihad. So let's assume that UNRWA is dismantled and that Hamas is somehow unseated. How long would it take to re-educate and deprogram an entire society? And like, how many generations would it take to accomplish that?
It's a great question, and it does get into that. There is a whole academic field of study in post-conflict operations, right? So stability, what we call DDR, even reconciliation. So there, people saying, "I used to be Hamas, I no longer want to be Hamas," and they signed something. And Netanyahu mentioned it once at the on the national level about moving people out, letting them come back in. They sign a paper. He's talking about the historical reconciliation process, right? Step one is removing Hamas's power. And then you have many other steps, like you're saying, that after World War II, Eisenhower, in very bold print in national newspapers, said it would take 50 years to de-radicalize the Nazi, basically, kind of regime. It didn't take it because there was middle class, there's institutions, there's academia. None of that's present in Gaza, right? So first has to be that everybody recognizes that Hamas was defeated. That's step one to unraveling the de-radicalization. And then it takes de-radicalization, demilitarization, reconciliation, and it does take, you have to start in the books, just like after Imperial Japan. Step one was, before they could even replace the books, they forced the entire basically nation to sit in a classroom with their teachers and mark out the anti-Western and pro-imperial comments in the books until they got new ones. There is a school of thought on this. How long would it take? Again, Gaza Strip's very unique in thinking that it's a sovereign body of your population, even within, there's refugees within Gaza, you camps within Gaza. Like, okay, how can you have a refugee camp within Gaza? There's so many complexities of what getting to a path to something that somebody would view as normal in the Gaza Strip. Is it these separate kind of communities that have leadership within themselves? And within them, there is what we call inkblot strategy. So you could take, like, there's a strong clan, let's say, of that Hamas hasn't killed. And that clan said, look, I want to control this neighborhood of 100,000 people. And then you could flow resources like rebuilding, development, education, all these things that are very common in what we call post-conflict operations. But this gets you, but people will fast forward to, like, Gaza is a its own thing, right? And this is where you get to these very hard questions to answer. Like, well, what is the Gaza Strip? It's not Palestine, as in you can't connect Judea and Samaria to the Gaza Strip. They're completely different in border, political representation, people, everything. Can
Ideology,
answer how long?
governance.
Yeah, everything is different. So how long would it take? Forever if you don't start.
I love that. That's great. So I just a few more questions. Do you have a few more minutes?
I do
We're
have a few more. I got 9:30-ish.
okay. I'll just ask just a couple more questions. When I listen to Netanyahu's rhetoric, it seems to me like he's running on the assumptions of the Trump plan, but I'm not sure Trump himself even considers that a viable option. I think he just sort of like threw it out there and forgot about it. Do you think Israel can successfully pull off the Mira Gaza framework, and what role would the US play if they do move forward with that?
So this is, I wrote this article about strategy because this is where it's frustrating, is that there is, because it's so uncertain on all of these questions, like the population being allowed to go somewhere if they want to who, every element of even the IDF staying deployed at this scale for a certain amount of time, of the uncertainty for whether it's the prime minister, President Trump, and the administration to know, like, okay, this is what we need to do to achieve this goal. It is not that certain in any way there. So I believe personally, historically, what the Trump plan discussed was the most historical plan
Agree.
for a war like this, when you are invaded and attacked by an army. This just happened to be a terror army. And then you respond. Historically, borders change, population governance change, and there is displacement. That is historically foundational. And I would, people like Andrew Roberts, that I respect greatly as great minds of military theory, but there's Lawrence Friedman, there's other ones of, like, that's historically what the Trump plan was the most historically backed, clear-cut assumptions and statements that, but of course the world exploded. Like, how dare you say that? That's
How dare you have an actual viable solution that goes beyond the failed two-state paradigm?
yeah, which is, yes. Every war has to be looking at in context. And I get to travel the world looking at, war in Azerbaijan and Armenia about an autonomous region, and I'm in India talking about Kashmir. There's so many elements of this that are being protracted for the sole purpose of protraction. And they were talking about parts of the Trump plan light, but war is political. So there is this, what we call the trinity of course, you have the militaries trying to achieve the goals, you have the politicians trying to help even geopolitically achieve the goal, but then you have this kind of course, the populations and the uninformed populations about, like, what it is, what we're talking about here. Like, of course you can't say that people should be allowed to leave Gaza. That's like, why wouldn't I? But it influences political it pol it influences elections, it influences, like, so much. The international media lies and everything. I don't know, Shayna. That's the problem, is that it's so uncertain I know what should have happened, but I also understand that you always have to look at it on what is a plan reasonable. This is definitely reasonable. Feasible. Okay, now we're talking. Feasible to whom? Acceptable to whom? Like all these things that we talk about in like courses of action, right? What plan will is acceptable to who? Historically, it would have been acceptable to conquer Gaza because they formed an army and attacked Israel. Like that's like straightforward, but it's not as straightforward because war is human, it's political. I can't give you answers. I don't know tomorrow if there's an announcement that I didn't see coming because you there's more than just President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu talking about this. They're talking to multiple countries on, okay, are you going to be involved in this plan because you're part of this problem? Egypt, Qatar, Saudi, like all these elements, Turkey, you want to come in? There's so much going on here that people don't want to acknowledge that is beyond, this isn't a black and white conversation. There are things that I wish that would go away, like the billionaires in Qatar having any seat at the table. I mean, why aren't you been kicked out of Qatar and go hang out with what's left of the Hamas in Gaza? There's so many elements of this that are frustrating because there is no clear answer to how does this end.
Yeah. And ultimately, I don't think that any of these Middle Eastern countries would like to posture how much they care about Gaza, care about Gaza at all. Nobody wants a piece of this. And so, yes, all these talked about having like an international force come in to govern. Somebody has to be able to go in order for that to happen. So I guess my last question about the future of Gaza, will Israel have to maintain an indefinite military presence in Gaza, regardless of who winds up governing the strip? Because you have to be able to trust them that they will not allow them to remilitarize, to dig tunnels, to do build their infrastructure back up. Or do you think that Israel may be able to execute a strategy closer to the Lebanon model, where the IDF only intervenes as specific threats emerge?
It's a great question with a lot of assumptions there on what will become of the Gaza Strip. I believe that Israel, and they've stated this isn't my belief, the entire administration says they will always have, even as we were talking very last night when Trump asked a question about the two-state solution, he turned to the prime minister answered it. Everybody wants self-determination, but Israel will always have its security in take its security in its own hands. So they will have a security presence. What does that look like, right? So is it the ABC zones and different areas have different self-determination and security authority in combination? I don't see any scenario in the Gaza Strip where the IDF cannot have a security presence. Now you're right, there's
For
different
how long?
forever.
Wow. Okay. That's a mighty long time.
It's as you've been there, you're talking two football fields away. This isn't like there is a clear demarcation of the border, although the security of the border will be different. And the assumptions that went into the threat, self-determination over there, just don't attack us. The elements of that will change. But no, the lessons learned is October 7th should have changed everything to include when a threat says, I want to kill you, that will be taken seriously, and Israel will maintain a security presence in some way. I can't tell you what that looks like. And you're right, the Lebanon model, although that was a failed model, right? So of course, the Lebanon war occupation element of that failed. If the enemy has a safe area to go away, of course, it's going to just keep attacking you. The UNIFIL model, failed model, Hezbollah built an army inside, right underneath the nose of the UNIFIL headquarters. I've been there. I looked down on it. There's UNIFIL. There's the Hezbollah bunker. I don't know what it's going to look forward to, but I can pretty much say because Israel says, and I believe them, that they will have a security presence, period, and the ability to act. And this is why, again, even with Iran, we're talking about a new security paradigm of we see you building a bomb. We're going to try everything else but action to stop that. Well, that's gone, right? So that old status quo is gone. And that part of the conversation this week with Israel and the United States is what does that look like? When Israel is when Iran keeps building their bomb, it isn't the same status quo on when Israel will act for its survival.
I should clarify, when I said the Lebanon framework, I meant since last year, since the beepers and the pagers and the things,
Israel
not
has been
since the
doing
Lebanon
operations
war.
against, despite the ceasefire, which is amazing that it's held, and that Lebanese army is doing something finally. The Lebanese government is doing things. Hezbollah is still there, but Israel is also continuing operations against threats. And most people, because the status quo isn't the same, right? So you're not going to have a rocket pointing at the heads of northern Israel anymore. Like, that's part of the ceasefire agreement, but I'm going to take it out when I see it. Like, that's kind of like, it's a new status quo.
Yeah, that's the model to which I refer.
Yes.
Okay, John, before we end, can you tell us about your Urban Warfare Institute, its mission, and how can people support your work?
Sure. So I built, because of the complexity of even my work, I put together a team of people and created this nonprofit educational institute with the goal of doing this, being having a collection of experts who understand war, urban warfare, and everything. So these are people that I've known for years, put them together into a group so that we can continue working outside of my other work. I have many hats. So created the Urban Warfare Institute. You can go to the just Google Urban Warfare Institute, go to our website. There is a way to donate to the work, which is to keep this research in that realm going and building the experts, because I've been a one man person in a butt kicking contest with one leg, right? That saying. So we need more people who are educated enough to win the next moment, because I believe only the dead have known the end of war, that we have experts to help inform all these different audiences, like we've been talking about. That's what the Urban Warfare Institute is trying to do. But of course, that takes resources, and it takes not just people, but funding as well.
Absolutely. So, acknowledging that you're neither Jewish nor Israeli, what do the words Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
To mean, it means a beautiful amount of people trying to survive in a very rough neighborhood. For me, it meant my friends that I lost on October 7th. For me, it means the strength of the Israeli people, to include the Jewish people going back a millennia, that is the one Jewish nation, and they will always fight, from the saying of returning to Jerusalem to having this amazing democracy, this strong democracy that benefits the world in Israel.
That's beautiful. Hey, John, thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for defending the Jewish state. And thank you for just being you. I think you're an incredible you. And Am Yisrael Chai.
Thank you, Shana. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too.